Well, we're on time this week. Welcome to this third lecture in the Darwin College lecture series on risk. This isn't really commercial, but there are copies of the publications from previous lecture series on sale in the hall, and there'll be someone there ready to take your money on your way out if you want. So far, we've looked at how notions of risk can be communicated and at how they can be misused. And tonight, we're going to look at how our brains appear to manage them. Our subject is the neural basis of decision-making under uncertainty. And our speaker is Professor John O'Doherty, who's at Trinity College Dublin. He's the Thomas Mitchell Professor of Cognitive Neuroscience. He was educated in maths and psychology at Trinity College and then did his doctorate at Oxford. And he's worked at University College London and he's worked at Caltech. His research has been concerned with how the brain deals with reward stimuli. He uses magnetic imaging data to deduce where and how the functions of the brain, such as decision-making and emotion and social cognition, where they come from and what they do. And he's currently developing computational models to refine these studies. So we couldn't have someone better to tell us about what happens if you burrow inside your skulls and look at risk in the brain. John O'Doherty.
Okay, well, thank you very much, and I'd like to thank the master and the organizers of this series for inviting me. It's a huge privilege to be able to come here and talk to you and come to sunny Cambridge from Dublin here. And this is a little bit of a misrepresentation, the sunny sky here, because it's, I think, about one day a year that we have this in Dublin. But I think you're not that far behind here in Cambridge either. So what I want to talk about today is really introduce you to a relatively new field of investigation within neuroscience called, depending on who you talk to, decision neuroscience or neuroeconomics. And really what this field is concerned with is trying to understand what goes on in the brain, really what are the algorithms, what are the rules, almost like a computer program, what's the programs that the brain uses to solve the problem of making decisions under situations of uncertainty. And really, if you think about it, pretty much all decisions, or most decisions that we make in our lives, are made under conditions of uncertainty. So we don't know all of the pros and cons. We don't know exactly what's going to happen. There are uncertain outcomes. And that can be for the simplest decision, whether it's deciding what would I like to have for dinner this evening, or if I go to a restaurant, you know, what item should I choose from the menu? So even if you've been there before, you don't know, maybe the chef is off today, you know, maybe something bad's going to happen, maybe the chef's had norovirus, you know, so you don't know what's going to happen. So you're, even that is under a situation of uncertainty, up to kind of big life decisions, you know, what career should I choose? So the question is, you know, how does the brain actually do this? And I think one thing I should say is the brain's actually very good at doing this. And we know that because humans are extremely successful, right? We've been very successful as a species, so clearly we're very good decision makers. So clearly something that's going on in our brains is doing very well. Okay, so how does it do it? So the first sort of intuition as neuroscientists that we had as to, you know, the functions of the brain in decision making came from a case back in the 19th century. A very famous case now, many of you may have heard of this, called Phineas Gage. I think he's found his way into introductory neurology and introductory psychology textbooks by now. And he was a railroad construction worker in the US. And what they would do is he would kind of blast rock every day. And that involved drilling a hole and then filling it with blasting powder and covering it with sand and then compacting all of that with a tamping iron, okay? And that tamping iron is that thing you can see him holding up there. So just this big iron rod. But one day, outside the small town of Cavendish in Vermont, around 4:30 p.m., an explosion blasted an iron through poor Gage's skull, and it went through under his eye socket into his brain and out the other side. And a physician at the time, Harlow, was Gage's physician, and he reported on the fact that there appeared to be a big change in Gage's behaviour. So he said, you know, the equilibrium or balance, so to speak, between his intellectual faculties and animal propensities seems to have been destroyed. So after he had this brain injury, he is fitful, irreverent, indulging at times in the grossest profanity, which wasn't previously his custom, manifesting but little deference for his fellows, impatient of restraint or advice when it conflicts with his desires, at times pertinaciously obstinate, yet capricious and vacillating, devising many plans of future operations which are no sooner arranged than they are abandoned in turn for others appearing more feasible. So what you can see there is apparently he seems to be having some difficulties making decisions. He makes them and then he reverses them and he sort of comes back. It sounds like how I make decisions, but that's a different story. Previous to his injury, he possessed a well-balanced mind and was well-regarded by those who knew him, but afterwards his friends and acquaintances said he was no longer Gage. Okay, so that's the first sort of observation, that, you know, having damage to your brain appears to impact on your personality and behavior, but also hidden in there, you can see it seems to be impacting on his ability to make decisions. And more recently, Hannah DiMaggio and her colleagues used computer techniques to sort of reconstruct where this tamping iron might have actually gone, which parts of the brain might have been impacted. So you can sort of see it coming in here onto the eyeball, and it's coming through this more anterior part of the brain. So you can see there's the eyes there, and it's basically coming up through here and destroying that bit of cortex. And the part of the brain that is actually destroying is called, or mostly impacting, is called the ventromedial prefrontal cortex. So just to orient you, this is the front of the brain, this is the back, and this area in blue here, this kind of certainly from here downwards, would be part of this ventromedial prefrontal cortex. And another part that would often be thought of as part of this area is an area called the orbitofrontal cortex, and so called because it's just above the orbits of the eyes. So this region, together with this, collectively can be called the ventromedial prefrontal cortex. And this was the area that seemed to be most, at least according to Hannah DiMaggio and her colleagues, most impacted in Phineas Gage. Now, more recent work on has been done by Anton Bishara and his colleagues, and they were also, as Hannah DiMaggio, at Iowa, at the University of Iowa at the time. And Anton Bishara and colleagues had access to patients, to human patients, that had the misfortune of having this part of the brain, this ventromedial prefrontal cortex, damaged in some way. So that can happen through, it could happen through having a head injury, or it could happen from having a tumor, or a stroke. There's all sorts of reasons why this bit of the brain can get damaged. And they took a group of these patients, and they tested them in the laboratory on very simple decision-making tasks. And the canonical example is they call the Iowa gambling task. Basically, what it involves is a patient or a subject has to choose between four decks of cards, okay? And they choose a card on each trial. They just make a choice. And they either win money when they do so, or they win money and then they lose money. Okay, so they either, so basically their net gain can either be positive, so they accumulate money, or after a series of choices on some decks, they actually start to lose more than they gain. Okay, so they identified some of these decks, and they call them advantageous decks because you win more than you lose, so your kind of net gain is cumulative, whereas other decks are so-called disadvantageous decks, in that if you choose those, you tend to lose more than you win. So there are disadvantageous decks. And what they found was that the patients with damage to their ventromedial prefrontal cortex were actually very, very bad at learning to choose the advantageous decks. So that's kind of, you know, down here. It's very hard to see that, probably, especially at the back. But basically what it means is that they were sort of very, very bad at converging on the advantageous decks, whereas human subjects who didn't have damage, so controls, or patients who had damage to other parts of their brain, were actually able to do this. So over time, they gradually learned through trial and error to choose the advantageous dex. So that was the first report that damage to this, or at least formal study in the laboratory, that damage to this area impacts on one's ability to make good decisions in an experimental context. And the other thing that's sort of been reported about these patients is, just like Phineas Gage, is that often they're very bad after their injury. Sadly, their lives fall apart. So they make very, very bad financial decisions. They make inappropriate social decisions. Sometimes their marriages collapse. And they generally just become very fickle individuals. Okay, so the question would be, well, what's actually going on? So what's going on in this region of the brain, or indeed other bits of the brain, that are supporting the ability for people to make good decisions? And what sort of concepts do we need to sort of understand what's going on? So one concept that I think is very important is this notion of utility. And we can go back to Jeremy Bentham, the utilitarian philosopher, to sort of get a handle on this. So he said, "Nature has placed mankind under the governance of two sovereign masters, pain and pleasure. It is for them alone to point out what we ought to do, as well as to determine what we shall do. They govern us in all we do, in all we say, in all we think." So clearly, our behavior is shaped by seeking out good things, gaining pleasure, and avoiding bad things, avoiding pain. And he said that utility is that property in any object whereby it tends to produce benefit, advantage, pleasure, good, or happiness, or to prevent the happening of mischief, pain, evil, or unhappiness. So this notion of utility is some sort of abstract construct that refers to the ability or the propensity of an object to confer pleasure or confer pain, or not confer pain, should I say. And of course, this idea is very central in modern economics. So the idea is that a rational agent will make decisions, will take choices in order to maximize his or her expected utility. So they want to, this construct of utility. If you're rational, you should be doing everything you can to increase that and maximize that and avoid things that compromise or go against that aim. Now, of course, according to this, you know, Bentham, utility was just some property that was inherent in an object, but it does have a more subjective property. So I might assign a higher utility to apples than oranges, meaning I might prefer apples than oranges. I might think that confers more benefit to me, whereas someone else may have the opposite utility. And sort of differences in preferences can occur between individuals and even across time for one individual. So I may like heavy metal music when I'm younger, but later I will develop a penchant for opera, right? So your preferences aren't constant. Now, another concept which kind of moves away from economics for a while is a notion from psychology, from the psychology of learning, and constructs called positive and negative reinforcers. So a positive reinforcer can just be operationalized as really anything an animal will work to attain, okay? Whereas a negative reinforcer is anything an animal will work to avoid, okay? And so psychologists of learning, such as Edward Thorndike here, back in the turn of the late 19th century, study the mechanisms by which animals learn to shape their behavior, to take actions in order to maximize their probability of obtaining positive reinforcers and minimize the probability of obtaining a negative reinforcer. And what you can see here is this dog who is receiving a little treat from his master, and maybe this dog, in order to get that treat, he went around and played dead or did some other act, and now he's receiving the treat that he's expecting because he performed this action. Or maybe the dog is thinking, every time I play dead, this guy up here gives me a treat. I've really got him under control. And some reinforcers probably have innate value. So there are probably certain things that we're all pretty much programmed to find rewarding and to want to perform actions in order to obtain. And, you know, it's actually still controversial as to what those might be, but some candidates might be sweet taste, might be a positive reinforcer, bitter taste, which sort of is often found in poisons. Sometimes might be a negative reinforcer, though clearly not always, because some of us like tonic water occasionally. And caloric content, so just the post-ingestion, the changes in the content of the food, how much calories it has, might also be something that's a positive reinforcer, and maybe also sometimes a negative one. Water, the smell of rotting foods, painful touch. So, you know, there are probably not that many examples, but you can certainly think of more than these. And these might be things that were more or less sort of programmed to find reinforcing, because, you know, we need to be able to have our glucose, our carbohydrates, our water. We want to avoid poisons, and we want to avoid pain in order to survive and procreate. And also these positive and negative reinforcers can produce stereotyped patterns of responding. So, for example, a positive reinforcer like a food will cause us to salivate. You've all heard of the Pavlov's dogs story. So clearly we'll salivate in anticipation of food. We'll approach food. And there's also stereotype responses that we might do to bad things, like we might try and withdraw, we might sort of develop defensive reactions, and so on. Okay, so there are sort of stereotyped responses which indicate that these are probably sort of in some way sort of innate responses. But other reinforcers have learned value through association with other more primary reinforcers. So an example could be, you know, the sight of food or the packaging on one's favorite chocolate bar, right? They're clearly not something that is, you know, you will have assigned value to from birth, but it's something that you will have learned through experience that when you see that packaging, it means that you can get this nice chocolate, for example. And perhaps the most ubiquitous secondary reinforcer, a secondary reinforcer is what you call a reinforcer that's been has value through learning as opposed to having innate value. And perhaps the most ubiquitous one of these is money, of course. Clearly, we all use money. It doesn't have any intrinsic value in its own right. It's simply something that is associated with our ability to obtain other kinds of more basic reinforcers. Although they do say money doesn't buy you love, but it'll certainly buy you pretty much everything else. So we probably agree on the reinforcer value or utility of certain things, such as primary reinforcers. I should say again, you know, some people may like pain, so there are certainly some exceptions to that. But pretty much we probably agree that certain things have fundamental reinforcer value, but there's plenty of room to disagree on other things, i.e. develop complex preferences, because our learning experiences are going to be all very different. Now let's get on to decision-making. So here is a canonical decision problem. So this is sort of a very good example of the problems faced by any organism, a human or even an artificial system, let's say a robot, trying to make good decisions in the face of uncertainty. So it's called the three-armed or N-armed bandit problem. And what you can imagine is you're in Las Vegas, and you've got these three slot machines in front of you, okay? And you want to win as much money as possible because, of course, that's what economics says you should be doing. You should be maximizing your expected utility, win as much money as you can. But the problem is you don't know which of these machines pays out the most money. So you know, let's say, that one of them probably is better than the others, but you just don't know which one of these is the best one. So the question is, how do you solve that problem? How do you actually learn to choose the one that gives you the most money? Well, I guess probably what you do is you'd sample the machines and see what you get, okay? And, you know, let's say here you sample this, and you're in Vegas, so you win a dollar, okay? And you might try these other machines. And you might do that sequentially through trial and error. Now, what's going on, or what would you imagine might be going on in your brain that allows you to sort of eventually decide that you're going to choose one of these machines over the other? Well, what might be going on is that you might build up an internal representation in your head about the average reward, the average amount of money that you're winning on the different machines, okay, based on your past experience. And you might use that to try and predict the future. Okay, so you say, well, if I got a lot of reward on this green guy and I didn't get much on these guys, well, probably that means this guy's the one that's giving me the most money. So what you might build up is a representation of the expected utility, the expected average reward or expected reward that you're going to get on the different machines, and then you might then decide to choose one machine over the others based on the fact that the expected utility of that is higher. Now, the other thing that has to happen before even you have an expected utility is you need to be able to understand that some things are rewarding and other things are not. So clearly what's rewarding in this case, I should go back here, is winning the money, right? So there could be other flashing things going on in the slot machine that probably isn't that relevant and not rewarding. What you really want to know is to be able to discriminate things that are rewarding from those things that are not, those things that have utility and those things that are not. So what you might need to do that is to be able to process or process your experienced utility, okay? So in other words, you need to be able to understand that certain things give you pleasure and that they feel good to have them when you get them. And this is what happens when you actually get an outcome. Okay, so some part of your brain needs to be able to say, aha, this is rewarding. So how does that happen? Well, how can we study this in the brain? Well, simplest thing we could do is just give stuff to somebody of various kinds of materials, various kinds of stimuli, this person will report what their pleasure is, what their subjective pleasure or experienced utility is for these items, okay? And then what you might do is look for areas of the brain where neural activity correlates with those subjective reports of experienced utility. Okay, so how might we do that? Well, one way you might do it is if you're able to have access to somebody who has their skull open, you can actually go directly in and peer inside their brain. Now, that happens under only very limited situations, thankfully, and in particular if somebody were to be undergoing neurosurgery. And occasionally, as scientists, we can have the privilege of actually measuring activity inside a patient like that. But typically, of course, we can't do that. So what we can do, though, is make use of indirect measures of neural activity that we can actually measure without having to open up somebody's skull. We can actually measure it safely and painlessly with the person being fully intact and able to go home and have a cup of tea afterwards. And what we can do is make use of the fact that when parts of the brain are active, when neurons are firing and they're sort of processing information, they need energy to do that. And in order for that energy to be produced, you need glucose and oxygen. And that has to be delivered via the bloodstream. Okay, so capillaries near the neural activity deliver that glucose and oxygen. And for that to happen, when a part of the brain is particularly active, there's an increase in blood flow, there's an increased consumption of glucose, there's an increased consumption of oxygen. So we can sort of use any one of those indices and measure that indirectly without actually having to go inside the brain, then we can get a handle on what's going on inside the brain. And that's what this technique called functional MRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, allows us to do. And what fMRI does is it makes use of the fact, as I just mentioned, that there is an increase or an initial decrease in oxygenation. So if a part of the brain is active, that the neurons will use up a lot of the oxygenated blood that's around. It'll take the oxygen away, and you'll go from oxyhemoglobin to deoxyhemoglobin. But there actually turns out to then be a compensation. So there's a signaling process, and more oxygenated blood is delivered to that part of the brain, and there's an increase in the relative amount of oxygenation. And what's interesting is that oxy and deoxyhemoglobin happen to have different magnetic signatures, okay? They have different magnetic properties. And what we can do is use a machine called an MRI machine, a magnetic resonance imaging machine, which has a magnet in it that's about 30,000 times more powerful than the Earth's magnetic pole. And we can put somebody in there and measure changes in the magnetic signals due to changes in oxygenation. So that gives us a handle on what's going on inside the brain, because when there's an increase in oxygenation, it generally correlates with an increase in neural activity. Okay, and it's localized. So let's get back to our attempts to look at experienced utility. Let's take experienced utility for a pleasant food smell. So we probably all, when you go past a bakery and you get the nice smell of fresh bread, you know, that generally is a positive thing. So it generates positive experienced utility for you. So how can we study that? Well, we need the brain scanner. We need somebody in it. So we've got that. And what we can actually do is deliver different odors, okay, different food smells. So here we deliver, they're sitting in there, and we're pumping in these smells, and it's either the smell of banana or the smell of vanilla, okay? And the other thing I should say is that the person is hungry. So clearly, a bakery doesn't smell good if you're full. It only smells good when you're hungry, okay? So these people are hungry, and they're smelling these food smells. And we measure activity to these both of these things. And the subjects are selected to both to like bananas and like, let's say, vanilla ice cream. Okay, so they like both of these odors. And then what we do is we take them outside of the scanner and we feed them with as many bananas as they can possibly eat until they're full. Okay, so these are fun experiments, both for me and for the subjects. And what happens then is that the pleasantness of the banana goes down. Okay, after you've eaten it to satiety, you actually no longer particularly want banana, and the smell of banana is not particularly pleasant. But what's interesting is that the smell of the other odor, the vanilla odor, actually hasn't changed much. And so, because we have this property called sensory-specific satiety, and the way to think about this is almost like a restaurant phenomenon. So, if you go to a restaurant and it's an all-you-can-eat spaghetti place. Very, very, very upmarket, all-you-can-eat spaghetti restaurant. And you eat a big plate of spaghetti, and then you have the option of another big plate of spaghetti, okay? And you probably say, I really don't want any more spaghetti. I'm stuffed. But then the dessert tray comes around, and you're offered the tiramisu. You say, well, actually, I've got a bit of room left. And that's actually quite adaptive. It's very good because it's an adaptive phenomenon because it enables us to sample different foods and actually maximize the variety of nutrients that we get. Okay, so it's a very good thing. But it's also good for an experiment because we can selectively change the experience utility of this banana and actually look at what areas in the brain track the changes to the banana but that don't change to the vanilla. So we put them back in and we scan them again. Okay. And then what we look for are areas of the brain that show a change, a selective change in activity, neural activity, to the banana. So they should decrease to the banana, but not change to the vanilla. And the area that we found, and what I should say just to orient you, these light colors, these kind of orange and red colors here, what they mean is areas that show statistical difference, a statistically significant effect that we're looking for, compared to other areas that are not colored in. And these are five different individuals, and across these individuals, what's common is an area down here, which is the orbitofrontal frontal cortex, just above the orbits of the eyes, that's coding for the value of these banana and vanilla foods. And we know that because we can look at the activity there, and basically from pre is blue, pre-feeding, post-feeding is red, and there's a big change in the activity, neural activity, to the banana. And if anything, the activity to the vanilla has gone up, okay, which means it's actually, you might indicate that subjects actually find the vanilla a little bit more pleasant afterwards because it's not the banana, which is now no longer pleasant. Okay. So that's one indication that this area seems to code the experience utility. So another thing we can do, so you remember I mentioned that money is a secondary reinforcer, or you can even think about it as an abstract reinforcer because it's sort of been associated with lots of different primary reinforcers, so it has very generalized value. And we can actually get people to play simple tasks in the scanner while we're scanning them where they make choices, and they make those choices, and they can win or lose money. And here this person's won £175, Unfortunately, we're not that rich as experimenters, so we can't afford to pay them that. So this was just play money, but even if you use real money in smaller amounts, I should add, you get the same kinds of results. And we then measure activity, and what we look for in the brain are areas that correlate with the magnitude of the money that they win. So, for example, if they won £175, we'd look for areas for that, and then if they won 30, we'd look for slightly less activity, or if they won 300, we'd look for more activity. So we correlate the amount that they win with the brain activity. And what we find is, again, a region of the brain correlating with the amount that they win. So the activity here is bigger in this region here when they win more money, and it's less when they win less money. So you can see that here. So that suggests that this region, this orbitofrontal area, again, is more medial. It's called medial because it's in the middle. Orbitofrontal cortex is correlating with the reward value of money, with the experienced utility of money. The other thing that's interesting, because you remember Bentham referred to pleasure and pain, there's also a region more laterally in the orbitofrontal cortex that goes up the more that you lose money. Because not only can you win, you can also lose. And this area seems to track go up the more that you lose. So that might be tracking the punishment or the negative reinforcer value. Other kinds of rewards could include pretty faces. So as humans, we actually like looking at other people, and we actually like looking at people that are more attractive than we do looking at people that are less attractive. And so what we did here is we put people in the scanner. We didn't actually tell them we were looking at attractiveness, and we just showed them some images, and the images were either attractive people or less attractive people, should I say. I'm only showing you the people that were in the attractive category here. I think it's not right for me to show the people that were less attractive. And what we did is simply just measure activity, two faces that were categorized as being attractive by a bunch of other people outside the scanner and by the subjects themselves when they came out, and we compared it to times when they were looking at the low attractive faces. And we again see activity in this ventral medial prefrontal cortex correlating with the attractiveness. So it's more active when you see attractive faces and less active when you see low attractiveness faces. And I'm not showing it here, but we also found this more what's called lateral on the side area correlating with faces that were rated as less attractive. Okay, so again, it suggests that the experienced or hedonic value of this of these faces is represented in this orbitofrontal region, ventral medial prefrontal region. This is another example. This is not from my own work. It's work from Anne Blood and Robert Satore in Montreal. And what they did was, instead of looking at money or faces, they actually looked at music. So they actually played a set of tones to volunteers, which are either in harmony or not in harmony. Okay, so they varied the level of dissonance between the tones, and in a very when the level of dissonance is high, it obviously sounds like loads of cats wailing, or it can sound kind of relatively pleasant when it's very harmonious. And they just looked at areas that correlated with the degree of harmony. And again, the more pleasant and the more harmonious the music was, the more activity was increased in this medial orbitofrontal region. So again, it sort of seems to be representing this value or utility. Okay, so here's another example. So probably a lot of you like wine, as I do. And I would, here's a wine testing task. I'm giving you two glasses of wine, and I'm just going to ask you to tell me. There's somebody going to come down with the wine now. That's a joke. I'm just going to ask you to say, well, which one would you like? Sample it and tell me which one you like. Which one is better, should I say? Better wine. Probably many of you would fancy yourselves as being good at doing that. But what if I were to tell you that actually the wines have very different prices? So this one is £90, and this one is only £5, okay? Now, do you think that would influence your experienced pleasantness for the wine? Many of you probably think, well, actually, no. I'm just going to be very objective. I'm just going to sample the wine, and it's not really going to affect my experience utility at all, because actually I've got quite a bit of experience with wine. You might want to say that. What if I said, well, they're actually identical wines? They're actually completely identical. Would you detect that? And many of you might think you would. So what we did is we did a study of this. So we put people in a brain scanner, and they were actually getting squirts of wine into their mouth. So we can't give them a glass because it's very kind of tight in there. And they see the amount of money that the wine costs, the bottle of wine from which the wine is being sampled. So it's either $5 here, so this was done in the States, $5, and then they get to swallow the wine, then they get a rinse, they get to swallow, and so on, just like a professional wine taster would. And they get two wines. There's actually another third wine as well, but that's I don't need that detail. And we tell them, wine one, it's the same wine, but we tell them it either costs $5 or $45. So the same people get to sample the same wine repeatedly, but they think it's different wines, and they think it's got different prices. And similarly for wine two, it's either labeled as costing $10 or $90. And the actual price of wine one was $5, and the actual price of wine two was $90. Okay. And then we looked at activity in this orbitofrontal, ventromedial, prefrontal cortex area. And what we found was that the activity in this region didn't really track the objective value of the wine, whether it was 90 or whether it was 5. It actually was modulated very heavily by what subjects thought the wine cost. So activity was much higher, meaning more rewarding, for wine that they thought would cost $90, and was much less for the actual $90 costing wine when they thought it cost 10. And similarly, for the $5 wine, it was much higher when they thought it cost $45. So what that suggests is that our experience utility isn't just something that's objective. It's not something that is immutable. It's something that's very much influenceable by various factors, such as how much something costs. So let's get back to decision-making, because that's what the talk is meant to be about. So we know that there's this part of the brain that represents experience utility. Now let's start to think about how we can solve this this problem, this bandit problem. So remember, we had these representations here. I'm calling them V, VA, VB, VC, which are just coding for the expected value, the expected utility for pursuing these different actions. So then the question is, how do we actually learn this expected utility? So we can actually, to understand this, make reference to a field of computer science or artificial intelligence called reinforcement learning. And reinforcement learning is concerned with how to build artificial systems like robots that are able to learn from their environment and behave adaptively. Okay, so choose things that maximize rewards. Okay. And algorithms coming from this field have turned out to be quite relevant for understanding how brains and how people might make decisions. So the question is, how do we actually learn to build up a prediction of a high expected utility for a particular action? And what these models say is that what goes on is we encode the degree of surprise in our predictions. So we're always making predictions, and that's our expected utility or decision utility. And our prediction is either confirmed or disconfirmed by the experienced utility we receive. And the difference between our expectation of what we expect we're going to get and what we actually get is the degree of surprise that we have. And that's called a prediction error. Okay? And this prediction error, I'll explain it a bit more down here. This prediction error has been linked by a very distinguished neuroscientist here in Cambridge, Professor Wolfram Schultz, and to the activity of a certain class of neurons called dopamine neurons that are deep in your brain. Okay. And so that they've been shown to sort of encode this prediction error. And so what would it look like? So let's imagine you're coming along, you're choosing a slot machine, and you have kind of this is just the strength of your prediction. Okay, so it's either, this is very low here, you're not expecting anything. You choose the machine, you come along, you win your dollar. And what the prediction error does is it goes up because there's a big surprise. You weren't expecting to get anything, and you just did, so you won your dollar. So then you come along and you update your expectation because this was your prediction error was high, so you update your prediction. You come along again, you make a choice again, And again, you win your dollar. So this time, your prediction error is lower because you're less surprised, okay? And you still update your value again. So you come along a third time, you make a choice. This time, you actually don't get the dollar. Because remember, this is an uncertain world. You don't win all the time. Sometimes you lose. Now, this time, you're actually going to have a negative surprise, a negative expectation. So you're actually going to have a negative prediction error, okay? So this could be one mechanism, and we think there's a lot of evidence suggesting that that's how the brain, or at least learns about to make predictions about reward and utility. It does this through the activity of these dopamine neurons. So what we want to do is see whether can we look in humans and see how people, first of all, represent their expectations of future reward in the brain. Where does that happen? And then also, what do we see these kinds of prediction errors kicking in as people are learning? Do we find evidence of that? And what we did is we had people play this bandit task, except there are not three here, there are four bandits. And they're playing this, they're making choices, and they win points, okay? Now, the different bandits, they're not paying off the same amount all the time, but instead they're very variable in the amounts that they're paying off. And so in red here is the amount that you get on average across 300 trials of playing this game for choosing the red stimulus, the red bandit. And it starts off high. This is the amount of points that you win. It starts off high, and it goes down, and it's kind of middling from there. This blue one starts off low, and it goes up a bit, then it goes down again. And so what you can see here is that, you know, if to play this game well, you kind of want to keep track of your expected utility on the different machines because they're changing over time. And you want to keep choosing the one that you think is paying out the most. But you have to be prepared to always, you know, to shift around. And so we had people play this game. And what we did was we basically took this algorithm, this reinforcement learning algorithm, a simple mathematical model, and we correlated it against people's choices, so the choices that they were making and the rewards that they experienced. And the model made predictions about what it thinks, given your experience, if this were going on in your brain, what your expectation should be for your decision utility, your expected reward. What should that be? And you have this for each trial. As you make choices, you'll have predictions for each of the machines, and those predictions will change over time. And so, for example, here we might predict that the subject should think that the green machine pays out the most. This is the average reward on the green machine, whereas the red machine is actually not doing so well. It's only paying out 38 points. Okay, and this will change over time. And we can basically just correlate brain activity, where we're measuring it in the fMRI scanner, against the predictions of this model, and that should tell us where this expected reward is coded when they're making choices or decision utility. And where it's coded is in the ventromedial prefrontal cortex. Surprise, surprise. So activity in this area not only codes for experienced utility, it also codes for expectations of future reward when we're making choices. So activity is higher the more we think something is valuable, is going to give us something good, and activity is lower the more we think it's going to give us less of something good. Okay. And this is just another example from a different fMRI experiment looking at the similar kind of process. Again, it's kind of bringing out this same brain region. And we can also look for prediction errors, and we do find these in the brain as well. So we find these in a different part of the brain, and this is more if you kind of look, go through the middle of your head, down right into the middle of your brain, actually, in an area called the striatum, the part of the basal ganglia. And this area actually receives very strong input or signals from these dopamine neurons that Professor Schultz found to code this prediction error. And we find in humans activity that correlates with this prediction error in this place called the striatum. So what that suggests is it provides evidence that these kinds of algorithms might be going on in the brain to allow us to learn. And the point is we learn our predictions of whether something's good or bad through experience, and we learn it by the degree of surprise we have in our predictions. Okay, now, the next thing I want to talk about is how does the brain make choices between different types of rewards? So An economist would say that if you're encoding utility for something, that it doesn't have to be, you know, the same good. It doesn't have to be just, you know, the utility for money or the utility for food. You'll actually assign a utility to anything. And we can make choices clearly between very different kinds of rewards. We might decide whether we want to go out to the movies, or we might decide that we'd rather go to a restaurant or go to the theatre. So we're always making decisions between things that are often not very comparable in any obvious sense. And so presumably what we do is we sort of assign some kind of utility to these things, and they get compared on some sort of common scale, common utility scale. And so here's an example. Here's three items. Here's an iPod. Here's a U2 ticket in Madison Square Gardens from 2005. So maybe that's not that useful now. And here's a bottle of Middleton Fine Irish Whiskey. And I should say this, if there are any Scottish people in the audience, this is real whiskey, proper whiskey. What you'd do is probably compute a utility, and you'd say, well, actually, the utility of this to me is 14 utils, these imaginary units of utility, and this Madison Square Garden ticket, maybe for sentimental reasons, is worth 19 utils here, but actually this whiskey here is worth 2,000 utils, okay? Now, that would be my immediate experienced utility for whiskey, but sadly, I appear to have developed an allergy to whiskey, so it comes and bites me back afterwards. So as a rational decision maker, I'd actually say my utility for this, and it pains me to say so, would be zero utils. So I'll make a decision between this by ranking them. So the question is, how does the brain do this? And, you know, obviously what you'll do is you'll take the maximum utility. And so what you might imagine is that somewhere you kind of decode what the item is. You recognize it, it's a bottle of whiskey, or it's an iPod, or it's a ticket. And somewhere you'll value that item. You'll say, well, this is worth a certain amount of utils, this is worth a certain amount, this is worth a certain amount. Somewhere in the brain, these values will sort of mix together so you can then start to compare them and decide which one you want. So somewhere there should be a common area of the brain which represents the values of all these items that allows you to make a decision. So here's the task that we had. So we did this. This was done in Caltech in Los Angeles. And what we had is we had put people in the scanner, and we had them make choices between different kinds of items. So food items, and I should say these subjects are also hungry. They haven't eaten for 4 hours. And these are basically junk food items. Okay, so they're packets of crisps, chocolate bars, you know, stuff that's really not good for you, that you shouldn't be eating, but clearly something that people are motivated to eat if they're hungry. And we also had trinkets. So these could be DVDs, CDs. Here it's a hat that says Caltech on it. And these things, or it could be, you know, a pen or, you know, something slightly less useful or less interesting. And so the point is that people will have variable, interest in these items. So they'll have variable expected utilities or decision utilities for these items. They say, well, I don't really want a hat. I really don't. But I would like to have this DVD of Star Wars, say. And also monetary gambles. So you can take, you know, would you like an 80% chance of winning $4 or something? Okay, so the basic idea is that they see these items, and they're given a certain amount of money on each trial. They're given $4, and they can use some of that money to purchase the item. Okay, and basically what that purchase amount tells you is how much they like that item, because they would be prepared to give more money for an item they like versus an item they don't like. It turns out at the end, we just randomly, I'm not going to go into the details, but we randomly choose a few sets of items, and they get to, if they decided they wanted that item, if they paid enough for it, they'll get it. If not, they won't. I'm not going to go into that detail, but it's set up in a certain way that they should be motivated to pay the right amount of money that they think it's really worth. So this is sort of based on economic theory. So we have these monetary amounts to tell you how much they think this item should be worth. And on each trial, we can look at activity. So we get this willingness to pay, and I should say what we actually do in the scanner is we just get them to choose between either the item or a fixed monetary amount, which is actually the median amount that they're prepared to pay for all the items. So basically, on average, they should choose this item, the items, 50% of the time, and they should choose this 50% of the time. Okay. And what we can see is just, I'm just plotting their behavior here, is that they're willing to choose the item over the fixed amount in proportion. The proportion to which they're willing to choose that is proportion to the amount that they say they're willing to pay. Okay, so it seems that this is a very good, willingness to pay is a good measure of their actual choice behavior. And we can look in the scanner at areas that correlate with their willingness to pay. And what we find is, again, not a surprise here, the ventromedial prefrontal cortex activity there is greater for items that they are willing to pay more for and less for items that they're willing to pay less for. Okay, so again, we have this correlation with this sort of willingness to pay measure, which is an index of their decision or expected utility. So that makes sense. But what we want to look at is areas that are commonly active for the when you're making decisions over each of these three different items, whether it's money, trinkets, or snacks. And the area we do find, an area of ventromedial prefrontal cortex that's active whether you're choosing between a trinket or a monetary item or a food item. It just represents the value of that item in the world. Okay, so that's some evidence to suggest that at least this particular bit of the brain seems to encode the utilities of many different kinds of items, whether they're food, money, or anything else, which suggests that we do code things on a common utility scale and we use that to make our decisions. Okay, so finally, I think in the last 10 minutes of the talk, I want to sort of get to this sort of risk component of the talk, which, of course, is the title. Now, you know, up to now, everything we've been talking about has been involving decisions under uncertainty, and part of uncertainty is risk. But let's look at sort of risk more directly. So let's say I give you a choice between a 50% probability of winning £2,500 or 100% probability of obtaining £1,000. Okay, it's almost like deal or no deal. Now, probably, I would say a lot of you would say, I'll take the £1,000, thanks. Okay? But obviously, if you were to play this game infinitely, the average amount of money you'd get for choosing this one would actually be more. So you'd win on average £1,250, whereas with B, you'd only win £1,000. So you can basically compute the expected value, the probability times the magnitude. Okay. So, you know, you might say, well, it actually, why shouldn't you be choosing A? Okay. Well, obviously, one reason why you might not want to choose A is that you know that there's a chance that you could walk away with nothing. And let's say if you were somebody who had no money and you wanted to buy dinner that night, well, then, you know, there could be a chance that you have no money at all, and therefore you'll just you'll starve. Whereas you know that with £1,000, you're sure to be able to buy, I think, a pretty good meal for £1,000, I should imagine. Okay. So, so why is it that we're sensitive to this kind of variable called risk, this probability, 50% chance of getting of winning it, but this other 50% chance that we get nothing? Okay. Well, of course, we can go back to economics again, and sort of Bernoulli first hypothesized that actually what we do is we have a thing called a utility, which again we've been talking about since the beginning of the talk. And rather than expected value, which is basically expected value keeps going up linearly with the amount of money multiplied by its probability of getting it, whereas utility actually tapers off. So it's basically, it encapsulates this notion of diminishing returns. So basically, if I have the, you know, if my utility for winning 2,500 isn't twice or sorry, my utility, let's say, for winning 3,000 isn't twice my utility for winning 1,500. So you can take the amount that you win or that you're offered, and you can basically go up and just look at what that is in actual subjective utility. So let's say take our £2,500 and go up here, and it's actually not, the utility of that is not 2,500, it's actually just under £1,200, okay, based on this hypothetical utility curve that you might have. Whereas a utility for 1,000 actually comes out as being sort of just under 700, or just over, it's about 760 here. And so basically what that means is that with a concave utility curve that looks like this, you know, the value of 2,500 is less than twice that of the value of £1,000. So it's not the case that it's worth proportionally more. So basically, the utility of 1,000 would be 760 utils. The utility of 2,500 is 1,170. And you take the probability, multiply that by 2,500. That works out as less. It's not more than the utility of £1,000. So that explains why, according to economists, if you have this, if you're making choices and you represent the utility of things in this way, it would mean that you're risk-averse. And, of course, the other thing you could do is have, instead of this curve being shaped like this, it could be shaped like that. And what that means is you actually weight things more as even more valuable proportionately than smaller amounts. So it actually, you'd have, utility for bigger things would be greater. And that would then mean that you are risk-seeking. Okay, so it'd mean you'd really like to take the gamble. And, of course, some people are risk-seeking. Some people will like to take that gamble. Okay. But what about, instead of representing things as utility, explicitly representing the degree of risk or uncertainty? And if you think about this, let's take a gamble, a fixed gamble, which has different probabilities. And the probability 50% could be up here. Probability 25% of winning, let's say, £100 would be here. Probability 75% would be here, and so on. And basically what you can see, and this is your risk here, that your risk is maximal for a 50% probability. So it's only if you either win or you don't. So it's a binary gamble. So the for 50%, it's at maximum risk. You know that your risk is maximum of either winning or losing. Whereas for a 25% probability gamble, you know, most of the time you're not going to win. You're only going to win 25% of the time. So your risk is a bit less. Whereas also 75%, you're going to win most of the time, so your risk is also around the same. And you know for sure if it's a 0% probability, you're not going to win. And you know for sure if it's 100%, you are going to win. Okay, so again, your risk is very low. So your risk is really maximal around this point where you know, you're at a 50% probability. And what we can do is basically give people gambles in the scanner, and look and see, you know, is there anywhere in the brain that just represents this kind of this risk signal as the probabilities of taking gambles changes. And I didn't do this, but Kirsten Preusschoff and Peter Bosertz at Caltech did, and they had people play a game, and it's also, you recognize it, it's sort of play your cards right, sort of Bruce Forsyth. I don't know if that's still on or who does that now. But basically, sort of you make a bet. You're given one card, and then what the bet is the next card that's turned over higher or lower than the first card? Okay, so you can actually bet on higher or lower, but you do that before you see the cards, so it's a little bit unfair. And you see the card, and then there's another card. So by the time you see this card, if it's a 6 or a 7, you know what the probability is, roughly. Exactly what the probability is that you're going to win based on the next card, assuming it's drawn with equal probability. Okay, so basically you can actually quantify what the risk is for this kind of decision, and you can look at activity in the brain. And what they found is, again in this region, this ventral striatum region I showed you earlier, that seems to correlate with prediction error, you see activity that's correlating with risk. So it's basically showing this kind of U-shaped curve. So it's maximum at 0.5, and it tapers off as you're either certain to lose or certain to win. Okay. So basically, the brain does seem to represent this kind of risk signal. And again, Wolfram Schultz has found evidence that this signal may be present in these dopamine neurons that project richly up to this area of ventral stratum. Okay. And here's another example. And basically here, people, so this is a study that Philippe Tobler, myself, Ray Dolan in London, and Wolfram Schulz did together. And here, subjects see a variety of different cues that tell them something about both the amount that they can expect to win, the amount of money they can expect to get, the amount of points, and also the probability that they're going to win. Okay? So we can vary that independently. So basically, some choices are going to be riskier than others. And we can, again, just like with the Bosertz and Proyshoff and Bosert study, we can look at areas that correlate with this risk, which is formally the variance in the distribution, in the reward distribution. Okay. And what we also did was we measured people's individual risk preferences. So some people are more prone to being risk-seeking than others. They will like to take a chance. They actually favor risky situations. Other people are going to be more risk-averse, so they'd be less likely to want to take a risky option. They'd rather take the safe option. Okay? And so people vary in that, and we can measure that. And what we can show is that when people are making these kinds of decisions where they're seeing these different kinds of predictions of the amount that they might win or lose, activity in, again, this ventral medial prefrontal cortex correlates with their uncertainty, so this is risk signal. And across individuals, activity is stronger in this region the more risk-seeking the individual is. Okay, so the more risk-seeking they are, the more likely they're going to want to take the risky option. And the stronger the activity in this region correlates with this risk signal. Whereas in this other area, this more lateral area, again, remember this was also, we found a similar dissociation for rewards and punishments. This more lateral region in the orbitofrontal is stronger the more risk-averse people are. Okay, so maybe what you could think is, you know, maybe they're thinking more about the negative consequences here, the possibility that they might lose if they take that gamble. So we're starting to understand areas of the brain that seem to be correlating not only with risk and expected value, but also with individual preferences, differences across people in how risk-seeking or risk-averse they are. So I'm going to finish up saying to understand how the brain makes decisions, what I hope you've seen is that as neuroscientists, we can't just start from square one. What we have to do is actually anchor ourselves in ideas that have a long history in disciplines such as economics and psychology to really sort of grapple with and understand conceptually how the brain might be representing things like value, utility, and risk. And we can make a distinction between, a very simple distinction between decision utility, which is the utility of what you expect you're going to get, and you can use that enter that into your decision, versus experience utility, which is the value of the thing you've actually got, you've sampled, the hedonic value of it. We do see regions of the brain that represent these kinds of signals, especially the orbitofrontal cortex involved in experienced utility. And we saw evidence for ventral medial prefrontal cortex representing decision utility. We also saw other bits of the brain. I've by no means been comprehensive in saying all of the areas of the brain that are involved in this. Other parts of the brain that represent things like risk. We also saw that our utilities for things, our decision utilities, can be learned through trial and error, through a process such as reinforcement learning, or it can be instructed. You can actually tell people what the probabilities are, how much they're likely to win. And we also saw, as I said, that risk is explicitly represented in the brain, as are individual risk attitudes. And sort of open questions are, we now have a good idea where different kinds of utility or value signals are located, but we don't really know much about how these things, the utilities for things, actually get compared in order to make choices. So we don't know, is that done in one part of the brain or is it a more distributed process? You know, what part of the brain actually makes the decision? Which part of the brain calls the shots? Where does the buck stop? And the other question is, you know, why do we have separate representations of risk and utility? Because, of course, an economist might say you only need to have this non-linear utility curve to account for risk preference. You don't need to have this risk signal, and we don't know why that is. One possibility is that you need this risk signal combined with other very elementary variables to actually build a representation of utility, which you then use to make your choices. The other thing I didn't touch on, but is a really interesting question, is not just one system for making decisions, but there are several, and how do they interact? And what leads to decision biases or deviations from rationality? So that's another question that's really interesting. Sometimes we're not rational. Sometimes we do deviate from what should be optimal. And what goes on in our brains to cause that? And that's a very ongoing area of research. So back to Phineas Gage. So probably what was going on to underlie his difficulty at making decisions, or indeed modern patients who have damage to this area, tragically, is that these representations, these fine-tuned representations of utility, experienced utility, decision utility, are compromised. And if you don't have those, it's very hard for you to actually make good or optimal decisions. And I'd just like to finish. It would be inappropriate of me to be giving a lecture at Darwin College without, you know, making the point that the reason why these kinds of representations are present in the brain, why they are like they are, is because through evolution, these kinds of signals, these kinds of computations, were the optimal ones that allowed us to make good decisions. So presumably through evolution, these kinds of computations have become honed and improved upon in order to allow us to make good decisions and to procreate and survive and flourish. Okay, thank you very much.
Well, it all gives a new meaning to the notion of looking into people's minds. I thought it was a fascinating approach to the idea of risk, as to see how we make decisions, and how we make decisions by looking at which parts of our brains bounce around when we're doing so. I think that the unsung heroes of this talk for me are the, I imagine, students who engage in drinking, gambling, eating, mating, and spending while lying inside what I guess is a big magnetic drain pipe. It raises questions as to whether their behaviour was altered subsequently. And as a sort of economist myself, there is one crumb of comfort. I thought our subject was going to have to hand over completely to psychologists because bankers and others behave like demented lemmings. But it turns out that psychologists need us, and that's a very refreshing thought. It was a lovely talk, Professor Doherty. It's given us some very stimulating things to think about, and really things that take us very profoundly to the frontiers of the notion of free will, and that's really interesting. Thank you very much indeed.